The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello, and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition for this week. On this week's show, we're going to continue with a theme we started a show or two ago, talking about positioning your assets for use in and through retirement. And today we're going to finally get to a response to an email. I know this is an EDU show, but this topic was a bit prompted by an email where somebody wrote to us and asked us to provide them some insight as to how we would deal with kind of an asset positioning task in the years leading up to retirement. So what we call sometimes the transition period, where you're not quite retired yet, but you see the light at the end of the tunnel. You're maybe 4 or 5 years away and you're thinking, I shouldn't wait until the day of retirement to get my assets ready to be used in retirement because I'm just about to pull the trigger. So we're going to head off a bit in that direction. And today I've got Jim, who's on the show usually, and then Jacob is going to join us again. He was on with us last week, and he does a lot of the positioning work for our clients, so he'll be in a good position to kind of share some thoughts on how we do things. And you can, as usual, at least the way we intend this podcast to work, is you all out there who are listening and interested might take elements of what we do and incorporate it into your do-it-yourself plans, or maybe meld it in with other things that you've heard, or maybe try to replicate what we do. And we're open and transparent about our approach. So we'll see if we can provide that insight that listener was looking for about positioning assets in that transition period as you approach retirement. So Jim and Jacob, whenever you're ready, you can chime in and at least say hello so people know I'm not alone. No?
Oh, we'll just let you be alone there for a little bit, Chris.
You got me nervous there for just a second.
Yeah, well, I was hoping Jim was going to hop in there, take the bull by the horns, but I guess I'll step in first. I am obviously Jacob, as Chris kind of mentioned. I appreciate being back on the show. Haven't said anything too asinine yet, I guess, because you guys have brought me back for a couple weeks now. So happy to be here.
Yeah. Have you been out golfing recently?
I've not been golfing quite this year. Actually, I played once maybe a month or so ago. But my golfing has kind of fallen off, and it's been slowly being replaced by tennis. I am... If anybody, has followed the newsletter or anything like that over the last couple of years, over the last 2 years or so, much like everybody, it sounds like my friends and I kind of got really heavily into kind of pickleball and things like that. And then over the last kind of year or so, I've slowly been kind of trying to transition from pickleball to tennis. And I've just become pretty much fully addicted to tennis. So that's kind of nice. Taken my main focus. Still would like to get on the course and play some golf for sure. But just it's a lot more work these days to try and find a tee time. You got to do it weeks in advance.
Yeah.
You know, depending on where you're playing, obviously it's a little bit more expensive. I like the tennis because it's just so impromptu. You can just pull up to any, court at the parks. It's, you can find some cheap rackets at, thrift store or something like that. So it's pretty easy to set up at least some games and do that versus golf, which is a little bit higher kind of, entry point, I think.
Right. Yeah. I was thinking about golf. I was at the golf course today over lunch at a meeting. I wasn't playing golf, but I was at a Northern Colorado Estate Planning Council meeting. And there were a bunch of people on the golf course today, so I had a little trouble finding parking. It was so busy there at Collindale where we met. So that's what reminded me of your interest in golf. At least, I didn't realize. I knew you were playing some pickleball and tennis. I didn't realize you were effectively replacing golf, pretty much.
That's I'm not going to go that far, but a little bit more of a workout too, which is always good.
Oh yeah. that's what leans me towards the golf experience.
Yeah.
You don't have to be in shape necessarily. I mean, to be an elite player you do, but to just go have some fun, you really don't. Jim, how about, I know you're not a golfer, nor do you play tennis, nor do you play pickleball. Although I've heard that you're annoyed by a lot of pickleball players. That might get you in trouble with some of our listeners, but because I suspect we have, based on their age demographic, we probably have a lot of listeners that are really into pickleball.
I'm sure there are. And I won't say I'm annoyed by pickleball. If you're into it, God bless you. I just never got into it. Although I was at Sam's Club yesterday and I had to take this photo and send it to my sister. So as soon as you walk into Sam's, at least the one in Longmont, on your left, they kind of put all the crap that they're trying to get you to buy. And there were these bags of pickleballs. They were pickleball corn puffs. So they're these round corn puffs, green. I mean, this obnoxious green pickleball color, so you know it's purely natural. And flavored like pickles. So the little green pickleball pickle things. So I took a photo of it, sent it to my sister who eats, drinks, and sleeps pickleball. And she loved it. She wanted to know where she could get them. She doesn't have a Sam's Club membership. So I may end up shipping a couple of boxes, bags to her. She just, anything pickleball, this woman goes crazy over. So she was just, oh my God, those are so cute. Where can I get them? I'm like, cute? It's food. Remotely food. I don't quite think what's the
space,
guy now?
Space food.
Space food. If you saw the color green, if these things are anywhere near the green that's on the label, it is God, who can eat that crap? But anyways, I couldn't believe the pickle flavored little pickleball corn puffs. So yes, pickleball has gotten a little bit out of control, but God bless the people who enjoy playing. At least they're out getting exercise and doing something. Mm-hmm. Just because I'm not into it. Not everybody wants to garden or go fishing or sporting clay shooting, which is the stuff that I would do. So we all have our own things that we want to do. But Chris, you're much too modest. You should have told people that you actually did a Social Security presentation to the Estate Planning Council today. Do you want to talk a little bit about that or not?
I did. I was invited to share some thoughts related to Social Security that might be of interest to those interested in estate planning. So this council isn't just estate planning attorneys, but it's designed
it's
for people
hodgepodge.
Who are interested in talking about and learning about estate planning. And so the organizer reached out to me and actually reached out to you, Jim, and you turned him down and directed him to me. And so I agreed to go and chat with them about Social Security, and we turned into a lively, interactive Q&A. So the time flew by, and it was kind of fun. So
yeah, the guy who runs it, we won't mention his name out of privacy, but he is a financial advisor, and I've known him for a long time. And he kind of knew me back when I did know stuff about Social Security, but I haven't studied Social Security in years and years and years because it's your forte. So yeah, when he reached out to me, I was like, no, but Chris might want to. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that you went there and helped them out. Good. Yeah. All right. Well, before we jump into this, I want everyone to know that today, and I'm going to forward this email to both Jacob and Chris as we speak so they can share their quick thoughts on this. But remember, Chris, the little argument I had with that woman on the Southwest flight?
Oh, yeah, about the foot space under the seats, yes.
Correct. So I received several emails from flyers who took my side and said that I was correct because they were going by, again, what I call the drip line of the tray.
Mm-hmm.
This person who wrote to us is actually a Colorado resident, lives in Longmont, longtime listener of the podcast because he's reached out to me before about some things. I had no idea that he was a flight attendant for Starbucks. God, Starbucks.
Really?
You can see I wanted coffee. Southwest. Excuse me, not Starbucks. He is a flight attendant for Southwest. So he took a photo and blocked it off in red, as you can see, shared it on a Facebook group for Southwest flight attendants,
yeah,
and wanted to see who was correct, me or the person in the middle seat. And unquestionably, the person in the middle seat was correct. And he went on to explain why, at least for Southwest, they have those metal bars off-centered. And apparently it's to help the person and the window seat. Because of the curvature of the planes, the person in the window seat wouldn't have any room for anything. So they put the, you can't go by the your tray is all
I'm looking at the picture
yours.
Now. Yeah, now that I see that picture, that does look familiar being on that. And I would have kept myself on the left side of that bar, even though I understand what you're complaining about. But his explanation that you're sharing with people makes sense.
Right. So what he pretty much said, folks, and I'm going to have this photo in the show notes for all of you who fly, especially for those who took my side. Now that I kind of understand it, and he concedes the person in the aisle seat has very little room and that they can put their foot in the aisle, which he then quickly says, but as flight attendants, we don't like that. And I don't think you can have your foot in the aisle. I think that's part of the rules. You're not supposed to. My whole point, which he didn't address, is I think this woman was trying to stuff too much into that section. And had she let me put her backpack, which I offered to put in the overhead, and she didn't want it because there was none near her, it would have to go further up the plane. She was trying to jam it in that section. So do you see that now, Jacob? Because I know you fly a bit. Do you ever see something like that?
This picture definitely makes a little bit clearer as to kind of what's going on there. I'm sure I've dealt with this at some point. I usually try and get in that aisle spot because that just seems to be the best for my severe flight anxiety. But yeah, that leaves you with a pretty limited amount of room, at least fitting based on this kind of seating setup here. So I don't know. I think this is an interesting visualization.
Yeah, I'm curious. For those who fly, take a look at this photo. And let me know if the airlines that you regularly fly also have bars set like that. I'm going to have to check next time I fly a non-Southwest plane. Is this standard? I mean, I figured I would have heard about this if it was standard across all airlines. Or is this just a Southwest thing?
But I feel like, just real quick, when I'm usually flying United, Jim, and I feel like... this is not set up on United, but those are mostly Airbuses. This in the picture you'll see, folks, says it's a 737-800. So this is obviously a Boeing plane, a little bit different there. So maybe it's a Boeing specific to this series of 737 too.
Yeah. And so I'm flying with family usually. So it's not as annoying because the person sitting next to me is family. So we just kind of share in the space. Mr. Solo Flyer there, Jim, is going to have a different experience, of course, and gets the luck of the draw with who sits next to him. And they might be a favorable seatmate and may not be. So that's probably why
I
run into it.
He corrected me. She was right. She had that space, not me. You can't go by the drip line, so to speak, of your tray. he concedes the tray is all mine, but I guess from your knees down, it's not all yours.
Yeah.
And you got to put your feet to the left of that bar. And he does concede you do not have much room in an aisle seat under your seat.
Yeah.
But anyways, thank you, listener, who is also a Southwest flight attendant, for setting the record straight. I will have Joe, folks, put that photo in the show notes. And maybe I'll have her also paste in the show notes his email of explanation. But he did share it to a Facebook group of just flight attendants. Can I call them flight attendants? That's what we call them now, right? Flight attendants? Mm-hmm. They're not stewards anymore. They're flight attendants.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it was they all agreed that I was in the wrong, that I should have kept my 2 feet in that small little area, and that the area in the red box in the photo, folks, belongs to the person in the center seat. And then, Jacob, I'm going to look on other flights to see. Maybe you're right. Maybe this is a 737 issue, because I know Southwest mm-hmm. pretty much all fly 737s.
Right.
And maybe the Airbuses, which United kind of has more of, at least United out of DIA, Denver International Airport, we usually are on Airbuses. Maybe their seat is different. Okay, anyways, don't want to delve any deeper into that. What we do want to get to is a continuation, which will run this show and probably one more, that kind of ties in a lot with the market volatility that we're having with President Trump's, they're calling it the tariff tantrum, if you will, with what the equity markets are doing, getting a lot of people, again, concerned about volatility, sequence of return risk, trying to fund a retirement. And we received a specific question where many listeners probably find themselves. They find themselves in no man's land, if you will, stuck between an accumulator, somebody in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and for many of us, even 50s, who are still significantly far enough away from retirement that market volatility truly is just a buying opportunity. I know that sounds such cliche-ish, but if you are in your 20s, 30s, and 40s, and you don't intend to retire until somewhere in your 60s and 70s, you truly should be looking at downside market volatility as a buying opportunity. You might have some irrational, emotional fear of investing, which amazes me that people would, that far away from needing the assets, but they do. So you might be kind of investing with a little bit of risk tolerance built into the picture. But I know, for instance, with my niece and nephew who are only in their 20s, they might actually be in their just about turning 30 or 31, but they're either late 20s, early 30s, trying to drill into their heads not to panic at all. And both of them have shared with me they're not, and they're actually 100% equities. I did sit with them years ago and talk to them about their retirement accounts, and they have 100% in equities because they realize that their ages, they're not going to need this money for 40 plus years. However, if you are not fully retired in the distribution portfolio, and if you're listening to this podcast to one degree or another, you might be attracted to the fund number concept, which bleeds perfectly into what we call the see-through portfolio and investment positioning. So if you truly believe in our approach to a distribution portfolio and asset management, you might have been well-positioned already before this tariff tantrum started, that you hopefully weren't panicking too greatly. Now, even with us, we have had some people that we work with kind of panic a bit. It's been several. It's not surprising because everyone has different emotional reactions to market volatility. But for the most part, and Jacob, I think you would agree, because you're the one who takes the calls before they ever get to my level, it hasn't been a huge amount of people in a purely already positioned portfolio, retirement analysis done, distribution fully positioned. It hasn't been an outrageous amount of people who have emotionally reacted in a less than opportune manner with this volatility recently. Would you agree or disagree?
Yeah, by no means. Only a handful. Definitely not a significant, portion by any means.
So you have those two extremes, and that's what this person was trying to point out. Hey, what about us in the middle? So he writes this, and this, Chris, came from a show we did, goodness, I think right at the beginning of April, so probably about 3-4 weeks ago. I appreciate your episode about market downturns, but I was frustrated when you only focused on accumulators or retirees. Accumulation planning, distribution planning, that's what he's saying. But there is a third group of which I am a part. We are the near retirees. You covered accumulators who can just wait for their assets to recover, and retirees who should have already had a positioned portfolio. But what should those of us who wish to retire in another 5 or so years do? I'm trying to transition from an accumulation portfolio to a positioned portfolio. But this recent drop in the market, which is now more than 8%, I think when we spoke about it, Chris, it was 8%, which is now more than 8%. And Jacob, is it possible for you to say what the S&P has done or down as of today? Today is April 22nd, 2025. What's it down year to date? See if you can find that somewhere.
Yeah, let me take a peek. I just want to point out too on this email specifically, Jim, it looks like it was sent on the 3rd of April in the evening, which as some folks might remember, the 3rd of April was kind of after that first full trading day following the tariffs actually being announced, right? Those were announced following market close, I believe, on April 2nd. This person reached out at the end of the day, April 3rd, the following day when that first large drop happened. But let me pull that up here, Jim.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so he continues. If I sell my assets, my stock assets, in order to purchase principal protected assets, I have now permanently locked in that loss. And it may negatively impact my timeline. Ordinarily, I would not be too concerned about waiting it out. But this particular downturn is not caused by normal market forces. Is there any advice you can share for those listeners in the same situation as me? Before we go into it, we're probably going to cover this in two shows. But before we dive into this, there's a few things that I want to point out to this gentleman. And it's this sentence here that does stick into my head, as well as a couple of other things. He writes, ordinarily, I would not be too concerned about waiting it out. But this particular downturn is not being caused by normal market forces. Tell me any downturn, folks, that is caused by quote unquote normal market forces. What is normal market forces? It could be a reversion to the mean from just an overvalued market. I often use the analogy of a elastic. If you keep stretching an elastic and stretching and stretching and stretching it, it's going to eventually snap. But if you stretch it, release the pressure, stretch it again, release the pressure, you can get a little bit more stretch out of that. So if he's defining normal market forces as releasing of a rubber band a little bit, is just the natural release of steam, if you will, from an overpriced market and getting things back down 4, 5, 6, 8, 10% before moving forward again, and that the year still ends up, even though during the year you might have had one or two periods where it dropped 10 or so%. That is, I will agree, normal market forces. Markets move up, markets move down, but the general tenor is up over the long term. Now, how you define long term, a lot comes into play to when are you going to need those assets? But that to me would be normal market forces. But outside of that, you telling me the housing blow up, the bubble bursting of the dot-com, the COVID correction, which didn't last very long, the Great Depression, that huge market crash due to the overvalued 20s, there is nothing quote-unquote normal about those corrections either. So this one is being driven by a tariff tantrum. Is it normal? Well, there is nothing normal except what I previously described, the normal gyrations of equity markets, because they don't go up every single day in a row. Some studies have shown they go up about 60% in any given day. They're up 60% of the time and down 40% of the time. I don't remember that study. I don't know if it's still accurate, but I just remember that statistic in my head on any given day. Then if you go out into any given year, any given three-year period, five-year period, 10-year period, the amount of down in those time frames diminishes greatly to the point where it may only be a handful of times where over those longer time periods, equities are ever down, if at all. So the general tenor is, yes, up. But there's also a thing called reversion to the mean. And you can get grotesquely overvalued markets, of which many argued this one was. And you can have a lot of the unwarranted, in my opinion, market rally after President Trump was reelected in November, that strong performance. You're pretty much giving all that up and a little bit more. The point is, don't try to let either a political bias or you to convince yourself that, quote unquote, this time is different, to believe that this is just going to continue down forever. There's a thing in behavioral finance called recency bias, where humans tend to look at what's happening right now and convincing themselves it's going to happen forever, that this is not normal, this is just going to continue, these tariffs are going to eat the hell out of us, and 5 years from now, we're still going to be down, and I'm trying to retire, and the market's down 50%. It can be very easy to trick you into that, but you can look at any significant market correction, at least over our recent memory, and find what the pundits, the market historians or economic historians, we call them, are going to attribute to the market sell-off. And I would argue none of the reasons that caused those corrections were quote unquote normal. The normal is the gyrations we see in equity markets in any given day. 60% of the time they're up, 40% of the time they're down in any given day. But over the long term, the general tenor is always up. Can anybody show me a 30-year period where stocks have never been up over the long time? You can find 10-year periods. You can find even longer periods. Not many, but you can find. I think it's 66 to 81 or 67 to 81. Literally, the Dow ended right where it started in 81 as where it was somewhere in the 60s. But within that time period, it was up, it was down, it was up, it was down all through it. And there was ample opportunity to make money during that time as well if you had a very good, disciplined rebalancing and reallocation approach. But that is an extreme anomaly that I just gave there. So, okay, that's the first thing I wanted to say. I don't want to get any deeper, and many people will disagree with me on that, and that's fine. But it's the way that I tend to look at that situation. Well,
and I wanted to add one piece of perspective too, that because I've heard this before, not just with recent events, but in the past when the market has gone down, people feel this sense of regret that they didn't position or reallocate before fill in the blank happened. And, you know, his comment that now the markets are down, and if I position now into principal protection, I've made the quote loss permanent. Well, that's kind of playing a little bit of sour grapes, because the S&P right now is trading where it was August 12th of last year. So not even a year ago, not even close to a year ago. And so are you telling me if you would have positioned on in August, you'd now be regretting having done that? I would argue if you're close enough to retirement, no, you should have done it then. So what you have to forget about is the ride up and then down. You're never, if you get caught up in the, I missed it, I wish I'd done this, I wish that, I wish I had perfect market timing, what have you. Certainly you want to go to principal protection whenever the market peaks, right? No, nobody's going to time it like that. You have to get away from feeling regret that you didn't do that. But you're not rebalancing or positioning now back to, say, your portfolio balance 10 years ago and you're giving up all those gains you've had over the 10 years. You're literally back to August of last year is where we are in the market.
August or October, did you
August,
say?
August 12th.
Okay.
August 12th. It's in, a little bit later, it was a little, it kind of, went up and down. But it was generally up since then until recently, until, the tantrum started and, at least the sense that the tantrum was coming and then the tantrum itself that you're, as you're calling it. So we're not, you haven't given up a vast amount. And if your retirement is undermined because you gave up from the peak of the S&P this year, you were too close to the edge anyway. I would make that argument right now that if you can't retire and do what you wanted because you gave up the, and Jacob can fill in the blank, year to date, what we're down, although I could kind of look at it. I don't have
it's about 10, it looks like
about 10 that your only your stock investments, right? Everything else might be different, but say your full S&P 500 style of your portfolio is down 10%. If that makes it so you can no longer retire, you are cutting it too close. Now, yes, you gave up some. Had you reallocated into principal protection at the peak, which was not quite the beginning of the year, the peak was February 19th-ish when it hit the actual, the peak at 612, 613 on the S&P 500. Well, that would have been the perfect day, but that's, using 2020 hindsight. There's no way you're gonna hit that. So to feel bad or complain that you didn't hit it, I think is an inappropriate look at things. Just my two cents. I know it's a bummer that you didn't hit it, but you're not giving up vast amounts of your portfolio gains over time by doing it now. And the risk you run by not doing it now, which is the thing you should be worried about in early retirement, is even greater losses that might happen or greater volatility that adds to your emotional angst and all the other reasons why we want people to have money protected from volatility that they're going to be spending in the early years of retirement.
No, I love everything you said, and you took a lot of what I and Jacob were going to say. Great. It shows that all three of us are on the same page here. I did discuss with Jacob prior to today's show what I want him discussing. I never talked to Chris. He doesn't know ever. And it's wonderful that he picked up on much of what I wanted to cover, because that is fully correct. That if he needed to do this, if his retirement or anyone's, not just his, is off because he's now at levels that he would have been in August of last year, there was more difficulty to fund that retirement. I also, and Jacob, you'll be chatting shortly, so be ready. But I also want to address, Chris, now that you mentioned it this way, his saying, again, how he was wording it, I'm trying to transition from accumulation to a position portfolio, but the recent drop in the market, which is now more than 8%, it's now, if the market is the S&P, it's now 10% as of today, according to Jacob.
Year to date,
is a large detriment. If I sell a stock asset in order to purchase a principal protected asset, I permanently locked in that loss, and it may negatively impact my timeline. That tells me, Chris, that maybe he did need that market high value to fund his retirement. I don't know. But what I want people to understand, sooner or later, you have to sell. and selling a stock asset and buying another stock asset is not locking in a loss. What this is now throwing you under the boat, Paul, if Paul was here, Jacob, because I didn't go over this part with you. But what do we generally call it in office and to clients? If I was to come in and say, oh, we are going to blank from this ETF to that ETF. Do you know what that blank word is, Jacob? And I'll be impressed, folks, if he gets this. What is it?
Well, fingers crossed. I think you're referring to what we would call it, kind of in the office, a lateral move, right? Where you've got holdings tied to maybe the equity-like performance. In this case, I know we've been picking on the S&P, right? Maybe this gentleman has assets tied to the S&P 500. Laterally moving is when you would move from that style of allocation into a different investment, yes, but maybe it's still at least, you know, geared towards the performance of equities in general, right? So it's not a one-for-one kind of change, but you're laterally moving from something that was tied to the performance of equities into another style of investment that is still tied to the performance of equities. Is that what you're getting at, Jim?
Exactly, a lateral. When we tell people, if say somebody hires us after we do a retirement analysis for them and they want to work with us in a distribution capacity, longtime listeners know you do not have to have us manage assets to have a retirement plan done. We offer that service separately and distinctly from asset management. Or someone may come to us in the accumulation phase and like a fixed fee structure and feel it is a far more reasonable fee than an uncapped AUM fee. And they're saying, hey, can you take over management of my accounts? We will, if they're in an IRA, it's no harm, no foul. We can sell assets that we don't want to hold and put them in assets that we follow and due diligence on. But if they have brokerage accounts, we have to look at them closely from a tax perspective and things of that nature. And if we do deem that we can, from a tax perspective, move them, we'll then look at their holdings and see if they're reasonable to continue holding or if, in our opinion, ours are better. And if the two holdings match up, let's say we have one equity-based holding and they have an equity-based holding, but ours, in our opinion, is better than theirs. And because we have a fixed fee, it doesn't matter to us if they keep theirs or ours. But our job is to get them to understand that, hey, you have this for, let's say, large cap growth, folks. You have this as large cap growth, but here's the one that we would recommend, and we'll be able to show the two of them. If they agree that they can move it, and from a tax perspective, it makes sense, we have to sell one to buy the other. But we call that a lateral. It's not, even if it was down, even if it's in a down market, I'm going to do it. There's no rule that says you have to wait until your stock fund, even if it's a crappy one, you got to wait till it reaches where it used to be at one point in the past before you can move it into another stock fund. That just makes no sense. You'll lock in a loss. Now, granted, one could argue that maybe there would be a wash sale rule here, but generally speaking, if we can have a different investment, even if they have similar individual holdings, but at a different ETF company, different name, we would argue that there is no wash sale here. But assuming wash sale is not an issue, if you're moving from one stock-based holding to another because the replacement stock-based holding traditionally is performed better and may have a better chance of rising, we call that a lateral. We don't tell people, well, according to your records, it looks like in August of last year, it was trading 14% higher. We're not going to reposition that into this better holding until you recoup that 14%.
Yeah, that's called prospect theory. That is a bias that they've shown through studies that humans react negatively 2 to 3 times the magnitude to a loss that they compared to the good feeling that they get from a gain. So there's this unnatural human reaction that doesn't equally, you know, give you pleasure with the good and sadness with the bad feels 2 to 3 times worse from a degree standpoint. And so people get caught up into, you know, I can't sell that because I've got a, quote, a loss on it. And they just assign so much of a negative feeling to that that's irrational that it causes them to hold things that they otherwise, if we look at it purely logically and rationally, they should sell and move laterally in your example here. But that is a, you know, a great example, you know, describing how humans react to things through, you know, losses and gains. They don't treat emotionally equally, even though they should, if purely logical.
And keep in mind, and Chris, correct me if you disagree, and Bob, Jacob, you can correct me as well. Where the hell did Bob come from? He hasn't been with us in 2 years.
I don't know.
Yeah. And he would never be on a show anyways if it didn't have to do with taxes. If you guys don't quite agree, you can share it with me. But to me, sequence of return risk, which gets a lot of headlines, has taught people, sometimes unnecessarily, to fear selling if it's quote-unquote down. But you're never going to be able to always sell at the right time. It's impossible. And my thought process is this. Sequence of return risk is bad. Yes, if you are in a distribution portfolio. Listener, you're only in a transitional portfolio. You don't need your money for 4 to 5 years, you said. And even then, you don't need 100% of your money by any stretch on day one of retirement. Sequence of return risk is bad if you have set the value of your portfolio at some point in time as the value of your available retirement assets, and you projected your entire retirement based on those asset values. I don't know if you've done a retirement analysis yet. I don't know if your retirement has been based on what your portfolio was once worth at its high, which wouldn't have been more than about 4 months ago. And if it hasn't, if you haven't set any values yet, I would argue it doesn't matter when you sell. Now, from an emotional standpoint, it may, but there's no rule that says you can, thou shall not sell unless it's at an all-time high. I don't think that's the 11th commandment. And where I'm going with this, and to get people to understand, if you haven't set your retirement value yet, you could start doing your analysis now and see if the value of your accounts now fund your retirement. If the answer is no, you're not ready to retire. You wouldn't have been ready 4 months ago when your portfolio was at a high. It would, if you were that close to failure that a drop over the last 4, 5, 6 months ruined your ability to retire, Chris is correct. You probably shouldn't have retired. But if you run an analysis and it looks at your current value and projects that with your current value, you are able to retire in 4 or 5 years, you're on track for it, I would say there's no harm, no foul in beginning a repositioning now. Doesn't have to be a full reposition, and we'll dive deeper in. I'm just conceptually trying to get you to understand, to me, a concept or a theory or a belief that I think sequence of return risk has clouded the waters on. Sequence of return risk is if you valued a portfolio at some point in time and now you have to sell 10, 15, 20% below that to fund expenses. Yes, and your projection was you would actually be 8, 10, 12, 15% above that. But the fact that you've been suffering losses is now forcing you to sell more shares at a lower price and not lateral them into a reasonable investment like Jacob and Chris have been mentioning. but instead consuming them and forever removing those dollars from any future compounding, that's where sequence of return risk will eat you dead in retirement. So I'm not poo-pooing or downplaying sequence of return risk. I'm just saying it's not the situation that you are in. It's more emotional. Darn it. Why didn't I sell 8 months ago or 6 months ago or 5 months ago? It isn't that too long ago when your portfolio was at its quote unquote all-time high. That's more of a regret, but it is not something that's going to decimate your retirement. Instead, you need to, and when I say it's not going to decimate your retirement, it's assuming an analysis shows the value of your assets today will still allow you to retire. But again, if you needed the value of where you were a couple of months ago, you probably shouldn't have retired. Instead, what you are contemplating, listener, is a lateral. But also, because you're asking about principal protected products, you're also trying to, I think the biggest risk here for you, listener, is emotionally convincing yourself not to retire in 4 or 5 years. That, to me, would be just as big a failure as sequence of return risk. And to help protect you from an emotional standpoint, you have to put a degree of principal protection in on your portfolio, which by your own admission is lacking right now. And that if you tie that degree of principal protection to buffered products whose return is tied fully to equities, whether it's the S&P, the Dow, the NASDAQ 100, the Russell, the Morgan Stanley Far East Asia, all these indexes are now offered in buffered products. If you are lateraling to something that still is going to have some equity-like returns, albeit not full, unbuffered equity-like returns, but from an emotional standpoint, stop the bleeding at least for a portion of your assets. Not by any means do I think all your portfolio needs to be positioned at all. And Jacob and Chris are going to be talking about that next. But before I actually hand this off to both of them, do either of you two agree or disagree with my thesis?
I think I agree. I think the point that you mentioned in that description that you don't need all of your money on day one. And what you do need to figure out, though, is how much money you need in the early years, because those dollars should be treated differently than those that you might need much later in retirement, assuming that you hadn't planned to have a retirement of some length. You need to treat those things differently. And it's not an all or nothing. This is the whole point of positioning certain positions for certain tasks or deeds to accomplish in retirement. It's not move everything to principal protection or move everything to equities or move everything, this, that, and the other thing. It's our approach to positioning is kind of a logical needs-based asset allocation. So, And as I pointed out before, I don't think it's too late to start that process, especially for a transition case, that you're not stepping back in time to 5 or 10 years ago where you're moving your portfolio back to those levels and, in your words, permanently putting it there. First, you're not going to permanently put your whole portfolio in principal protection. That would be silly. But you are going to cement in so you can sleep better at night and be prepared for day one of retirement, have some, in our proposal, some principal protection on some early period of spending needs. And that, as you pointed out before, would start with a good retirement plan projection to try to identify what needs you actually have.
Jacob, before I start handing off anything on what I just said, I know this yeah. came out of left field. I didn't even tell you I was going to go in this direction. But you're learning the podcast. There's no script. We just talk. So anything you want to add to what
is? No, I don't think anything specifically to what either of you just said. I agree with the overall kind of sentiment. And I'm sure, this will tie into Jim where I think you're taking this. And I might have some touch points from where you take it from here. But I agree.
So that said, Chris hit the nail on the head. What you need to do, now that we set the stage to try to convince you and all listeners that you can stop positioning in a down market or pre-position. This isn't full position. This is pre-position. One thing to keep in mind that I have said repeatedly, and it's been a very long time since I've said this, but in the 25 years, actually 26 years now that I've been helping people retire, not once has anyone said to me on day one of retirement, Jim, I need all my money. You don't need all your money. Some of your money can stay fully invested, unbuffered, unprotected, unallocated. I would argue that even at 55, 60, 65, maybe even 70, some of your money can still be in 100% equities with no downside protection at all. If the spending associated with those dollars is spending that has clearly been projected to not be needed for 15, 18, 20, 25 plus years from now. If you don't understand what I'm talking about, you don't understand my concept of see-through portfolio and investment positioning, go back to last year, and we've done many, many series on that. You can find the podcasts on it. Go to our website, theretirementiraShow.com, or use whatever podcast thing you have. You can find those shows. We're not going to get into that. But I can tell you, listener and listeners, you don't need all of your money protected. And I'll correct Chris on one thing, and this is only because he doesn't know the verbiage that Jacob and I use. We always use, Chris, degree of principal protection, because there can be various degrees. This gentleman is 4 to 5 years from retirement. He also isn't going to need all of his money that we would normally put a degree of principal protection on, which you're going to describe in a second, Chris. He would not need all those dollars on day one either. Those dollars might not be needed for 8, 10, 12 years throughout his retirement. So they might be needed on day one, but they're projected to last 8, 10, 12 or so years, and he's 4 or 5 years from retirement. So I would go so far as to argue perhaps some of those dollars that we feel he may want to be positioned could still be fully invested and wait for the market to recoup, or could be in products that offer a quote-unquote degree of principal protection, no need for full 100% downside protection. He might be able to afford a 10, 15, or 20% buffer and allow him to have a significantly higher cap on those, a cap perhaps of 8, 12, 15, 16, 18%, depending on the index and the degree of principal protection. So we'll be talking a lot about that for the rest of this show and next week as we dive deeper into this. Before Jacob starts talking about some of how he works with people on positioning, remember, folks, I said I think he needs to first do a retirement plan to figure out what he needs protected. He needs to decide, does he like, and based on his email, I think he likes our fund number position portfolio approach. But many of you are DIYers who haven't fully bought into that. And you still like a safe withdrawal rate, maybe a guardrail, maybe a ceiling and floor, different types of approaches, one big portfolio, Monte Carlo probability statistics style investing. Whatever the case may be, do your plan first and try to identify the dollars you're going to need initially in retirement. That said, for us, when Jacob is helping people do this transition, we call it the Venn diagram portfolio, where accumulation and decumulation overlap. That little Venn diagram, that's where this gentleman is. When we try to get people in a Venn diagram portfolio, we first require that they do a retirement analysis to give us the two positions that need a degree of principal protection. all the remaining positions can stay fully invested. And when people see that, they tend not to panic too much. The two positions, a minimum dignity floor delay period, and go-go spending, which is a subset of the fund vision. Chris, can you, a lot shorter than I would take, explain to a DIYer maybe some back-of-the-envelope calculations on how they could come up with this in case they don't want to go to our podcast from last year where we spent 2, 3, 4 shows talking about it? How can someone kind of come up on the back of an envelope what a reasonable MDF delay period and explain what that is? And the fund vision, that new approach we added 2 years ago now, but only talked about it last year. We went one whole year without sharing it on the podcast. Explain that a little bit.
Yes, I think the best way for a do-it-yourselfer is certainly the aid of a spreadsheet is helpful, but you could do it on the back of an envelope where you've got to identify separately in our approach those minimum dignity floor expenses that you expect to have, of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare. And you should be able to assemble most of those via your current experienced spending. You should be able to know or look up pretty quickly what you're spending in utilities. You might have to track your food budget a little bit if you don't already track it, but it's not usually too difficult to come up with those with a little bit of effort. And that's what you're going to need to fund. Then it's a question of where is the money going to come from? So the first thing we offset from that in our list of years, and of course those are going to go up with inflation. So if you're looking at that, you're going to want to apply inflation to future expenses. And then any natural income that's going to come in. Now, a classic delay period means you're retired, but then it's a while before your income turns on, say your Social Security later on. So in the early part, during the delay period, all of your minimum dignity floor expenses might have to be covered by distributions. Then, so that's the first thing you're going to want to look at is dollars going to be needed for that purpose, your minimum dignity floor coverage until income turns on. Then side by side with that, well, then of course there's the longer term minimum dignity floor coverage, which you'll get some help from your Social Security, maybe pensions if you have them, etc. So the distributions needed for that are going to be lower. And we would propose in the long term, you consider switching from using asset distributions to instead using secure income if you don't have enough of natural occurring secure income to cover those minimum dignity floor expenses. And so you need that, but that's the long term. When we talk about positioning, it's mostly a focus on the near term years. So I'm going to bring us back to that. In the near term, above and beyond your delay period minimum dignity floor distributions you're going to need from assets, you also need to plan for any of your proposed fund spending during that time. And your fund vision refers to what you believe you would like to be doing in the early years. And for positioning purposes, we pay closest attention to those go-go years, which happen kind of simultaneously with your delay period. Go-go is typically retirement to age 75 or so. So a little bit longer than your delay period since most income turns on before that. But the point is you've got two categories of expenses that are in the near term going to need to be funded with distributions from your assets, your delay period minimum dignity floor, and also those go-go spending years on fund or discretionary spending. And knowing that you need that money in the first 0 to 10 years, we'll say, depending on, when you retire versus your age, that you need to look to your assets and say, I need to get my assets ready to handle that. It's most important for me to look at that first. My other assets that are going to be used for other things, particularly in the long term, I can allocate those in a different way. But in these early years, the most important thing is for me to protect my ability from a financial and emotional standpoint to spend as I intended in the early years so that I'm taking full advantage of my go-go period for fund spending, etc. So I think you could come up with some of those numbers with a bit of effort as a do-it-yourselfer, whether it's on the back of an envelope or probably more elegantly in an Excel spreadsheet, to figure out your distribution needs anticipated in years 1 through 10. And that will help inform you as to how you need to have your assets positioned. How'd that sound?
It was perfect. I didn't realize I was muted. Sorry about that. Jacob, anything you want to add on to that?
I don't think so. I mean, I could definitely touch on a little bit of the, you know, maybe some of the investments that we would kind of typically, or how we would kind of typically look at, again, some of those kind of earlier, those two earlier periods in retirement, right, where you're anticipating distributing from the portfolio, that initial kind of delay period MDF spending, the initial kind of go-go spending. You know, something that Jim, you and I constantly kind of chat with folks on, right, is for those initial dollars, folks, that you're anticipating spending on those kind of needs early on in retirement, right? You're no longer focused so much on a return on those dollars, right? It's the return of those dollars at that point in time, right? And that gets back into, you know, the degree of principal protection style of kind of investment approach, and sitting there and saying, hey, you know, I want to start kind of laddering these dollars out because I know they're going to be needed in the next, you know, 1 to 10 years as you enter retirement. And I want to make sure that in a situation, right, where maybe we're at right now with some short-term kind of market volatility, that from an emotional standpoint, right, listener, you're hopefully not sitting there and thinking, okay, S&P is down, you know, 10% year to date. You know, I can't go on that trip to, you know, Iceland that I wanted to go do because the market's down short term. Hopefully you're sitting there and saying, hey, you know, the money I anticipate needing in the next 1 to 10 years, it's been invested with the degree of principal protection. It doesn't really matter what the short term volatility is doing in the market, right? I still got that money there. It's liquid. It's ready for me to distribute from, and I can go enjoy that trip to Iceland if I want to. So, yeah, that's all I would add for now.
No, that's perfect. And Jacob will probably not so much on this show because we're running out of time. He'll be diving in to some of these products. But what do we mean by degree of principal protection, folks? Well, as the name implies, you can have certain degrees of downside protection. Remember positioning. I call it spending segmented investing. It is an offshoot of time segmented investing, which academics write about all the time, which the industry has termed buckets. There's some advisors out there pushing what they call the bucket plan. But bucketing, more as a verb, is just, again, a concept in retirement planning that says, hey, you're going to break up your assets in these different pools or portfolios or buckets, to give a better visualization, buckets, that's why they call it bucketing plans. And hey, this is the pool of money I'm going to spend over the next, it's usually in 5-year buckets, but you can see different lengths. Here's going to be the first 5 years of my retirement, the second 5 years, the third 5 years, the fourth 5 years. And they use bucket visualizations to show you. And each bucket, if you will, would be invested based on when you think you're going to need to access that bucket. So your first 5-year bucket is probably going to be in cash-like holdings. Your second 5-year bucket might be in more fixed income bonds, perhaps all designed to mature in and around the end of year 5, beginning of year 6, and so on and so forth. You get the picture. Spending segmented investing that we favor plays more handily into what we call a degree of principal protection. Now, in our practice, if we're working with someone, or if you DIYers, if you're doing it yourself, if you do run some projections and kind of figure out what your delay period MDF shortage is from retirement until when your full secure income is turned on, because you have a beginning and end date, it's fairly easy to figure out what you need in a lump sum. And if you just project accurate MDF expenses, food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, subtract from it your best guesstimate of whatever secure income you're going to be receiving during that delay period, as well as non-secure income, rental income, deferred comp, RSU liquidations, anything like that that's going to be generating some taxable income or non-taxable income, anything that's going to be pushing income to you during that delay period, You're obviously going to spend that, and that can be subtracted out from what you're projecting your MDF needs of each year are going to be. The net result during that delay period, which for some of you could be a couple of years, others it could be a decade or more. It depends on the age you are when you retire. But once you have an idea of that, Jacob, I know this is what you now do with people, you can actually pull that report from our software, do it yourself as you'll pull it from Excel, and you'll start to explain to them, Jacob, a concept that we call a spending timeline, which lends itself to this degree of principal protection. Jacob, would you, let's just say a person, not necessarily this listener, has a delay period MDF of 12 years. Are you going to, first of all, we would use a degree of principal protection for all of those 12 years, but would you use the same product for spending that is going to be needed in year one as in year 9, 10, 11, and 12?
Right. Yeah, no, definitely not, right? You're going to look at it, and we kind of look at it internally in kind of a couple of different chunks, I would say, right? That first kind of 1 to 5 years of this 12-year period that Jim's referring to, right? That's where we really truly are, our listeners, going to prioritize a full degree of kind of principal protection, right? I won't get into the specific, you know, funds or things that we would use, but just to kind of give you an idea, right? It might be something like, you know, short-term treasury bills in the beginning. It might be something like brokered CDs, multi-year guaranteed annuities, right? MIGAs. Those are the style of kind of fully principally protected, you know, products that we would kind of prefer for at least kind of first 1 to 5 years or so of that anticipated need. You know, after that point, years through 6 through kind of 12, like Jim's referring to, that's where we might get into a little bit of that concept of the degree of principal protection, right? Where we're kind of saying, okay, we've got the first 1 to 5 years really laddered out, right? It's in full principal protection. Doesn't matter what the broader market is doing. That money I know is going to be liquid, matured, ready for the you to spend from as needed in any of those years. Years 6 through kind of 12, right? You've got a little bit longer of a runway, granted, right? Not a huge runway. It's not like we're talking, you know, 15, 20, 25 years from now, but a little bit longer runway where we can feel a little bit more comfortable in saying, hey, you know, let's do a degree of principal protection, right? Let's take away at least a good portion of that downside, but probably with something like potentially those buffered products, right? Where you're eliminating the first, you know, 10, 15, 20, 30% drop in the market, maybe even the full 100% buffered ETF, depending on, you know, how comfortable this person is that we're talking about with risk from an emotional standpoint. But we're really kind of saying, hey, rather than locking in maybe a single digit interest rate like you would in the first 1 to 5 years and prioritizing that full downside protection, years 6 through kind of 12, maybe we try and get a little bit more, participation on the upside, a little bit more potential to participate in the upside by using that degree of principal protection and kind of expanding maybe some of the investments that we look at for that ladder. But it all comes down to, right, listeners, what your individual comfort level is with risk, right? It's not like this is a blanket approach where you can just slap it on every single case and say, hey, this is going to apply to every single person that we talk to. It is, you know, it does vary person by person, right? Some people might want more downside than others. Some people might be more conservative, more aggressive than others. It's a case by case type of discussion. But in general, from a conceptual standpoint, you know, that's kind of where it starts, is really kind of breaking it up and looking at that kind of liquidity timeline that Jim's referring to in that kind of way.
Okay, I know we're going to have to wrap up now, probably getting a little long. So next week, we're going to dive deeper into these degrees of principal protection and give some examples of investments you may want to consider, not by name, and in other words, specific investment by this, by that, but more by broad category to get you to understand conceptually how this works. But for this listener, what I was hoping he could walk away with was recognizing, I don't know how long his delay period MDF is and how long his go-go period will be, but I'm going to guess 6 to 12 years, which is where most people fall. That's a pretty big window, but maybe we'll use 10 years for our discussion going forward, beginning now and into next week. But if it is 10 years and he's 4 to 5 years from retirement, he's 14 to 15 years before needing his last payment. There's definitely, he could be 15 years, 14 years, 13, 12, 11, 10 years plus. That's a long-term hold. Much of his, at least in the way I'm describing it, much of his go-go and minimum dignity for a delay period needs could, in my opinion, be invested with no degree of principal protection. When you start getting 10 to 12 plus years out, I'd be receptive if his risk tolerance matches that. But if his risk tolerance doesn't match it, there are products where he could get much smaller degrees of principal protection. One company offers 9% downside, others offer 10. There's some structured notes where you can, we've never really talked about them much, but they can offer dual directional. They can offer custom downside protections. We'll try to talk a little bit about them next week. There's many things that he could do that will allow him to still get returns tied to the equity markets, but give him a degree of protection. So from an emotional standpoint, he'll start to feel better. And all of you in his situation, all of you who are in the Venn diagram transition phase and are 4, 5, maybe 6 years from retirement. If you're 1 year from retirement and you haven't done any of this, yeah, you'd be panicking a little bit more. I concede that. And you need to start making some choices. But again, if an analysis shows that you can start positioning, even if you're 1 year from retirement, you can start positioning at the value of your portfolio today. Who gives a damn if 4 months ago, 5 months ago, 6 months ago, you could have sold at a higher price? It doesn't matter. You're going to delay retirement because of that? That would just be silly. Or you're going to continue to hold, waiting for it to recoup where it was, running the risk that this tariff tantrum expands, or the war in Ukraine expands, or just some other bizarre thing comes out of nowhere. And then from an emotional standpoint, you convince yourself not to retire. That's where you sometimes have to say, okay, my timing wasn't perfect. Don't confuse sequence of return risk with just the, as Chris, I forgot what you called it, Chris, but you can wrap up with that. But what Chris described, some term that says your loss, you regret the losses more. And don't sit there saying, damn it, why didn't I sell 8 months ago? I'm going to wait. If the numbers show you can start positioning at the value today, just do it. Because the idea of positioning, spending, segmented investing, see-through portfolio, fund number, MDF, secure income, all of them, the idea is to help you spend before you become the other guy and help you retire and not become the Debbie Downer, where you delayed retirement, put off spending on fun, and then when things got to your liking, back to where your portfolio was at some arbitrary time in the past, maybe something has happened and you can no longer enjoy yourself. Or maybe you just unnecessarily wasted a year or two or three of retirement because you didn't feel comfortable selling at a level that wasn't the highest your portfolio had ever been. Anything you want to share with that, Chris, before you wrap up?
No, I think that's good. The feeling losses more severely than you enjoy gains is called prospect theory in behavioral finance. So you can Google that, learn a little bit more about it if you're interested. But
why do they call it prospect, you know?
I didn't. I think it's the prospect of the loss is where that comes from. So the thought of the loss, even if it hasn't happened, is kind of like okay. where you might feel that you know, there's also a disposition bias too, that you pretend like you really haven't had the loss unless you sell it. And if you sell it, you're admitting you've lost it and it makes you feel bad. There's all kinds of interesting things in the world of behavioral finance. But yeah, it's a good stopping spot. We'll get into a few more details next week, then probably move on to something else after that. So I want to thank everybody for listening, and thanks, Jacob, for joining again. And I suspect you'll be on with us at least one more week.
Thank you. Everybody.
Yeah, and before we wrap up, we will be having Paul on as a special guest May 3rd, I think, is when the show will air. We're recording May 1st, I think. Paul is a tax person, and Jake may be on the show with him. If you have tax-related questions that you would like the guys to answer, fire me off an email. Chris will give you how to do that and put in the subject line, you know, tax question, and I'll see if I can get the guys to answer that in a couple of weeks.
Yep, sounds good. So, again, thanks for everybody listening. And if you want to send in those questions, send them to Jim directly, jim@jimhelps.com. That's jim@jimhelps.com. Put in the subject line that it's a tax question for the podcast. And he can put those together and share those with us here with Jake and Paul on a tax-focused Q&A show coming up, as he described. So thanks for sending those in. That'll help the show be a little more customized to what our listeners want to learn about. And everybody take care, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jim@jimhelps.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.